one, but from a car seat. But I didn't have a strap for it, and I was unhappy about that. Then all of a sudden they saw some partisan commissar from the local district party committee wearing just the right kind of strap, and they took it away from him. We are the army. We have seniority. Remember Senchenko, the security officer who stole a map case and a dispatch case? Finally, I coveted that scarlet box, and I remember how they took it away and got it for me. That's what shoulder boards do to a human being. And where have all the exhortations of grandmother, standing before an icon, gone? And where the young pioneer's daydreams of future's sacred equality? And at the moment, when my life was turned upside down, and the smirch officers at the brigade command point tore off those cursed shoulder boards, and took my belt away and shoved me along to their automobile, I was pierced to the quick by worrying how, in my stripped and sorry state, I was going to make my way through the telephone operator's room. The rank and file must not see me in that condition. The day after my arrest, my march of penance began. The most recent catch was always sent from the Army Counterintelligence Center to the counterintelligence headquarters of the front. They herded us on foot from Ostoroda to Brodnica. When they led me out of the punishment cell, there were already 7 prisoners there, in 3.5 pairs, standing with their backs to me. 6 of them had on well-worn Russian army overcoats, which had been around for a long time, and on their backs had been painted, in indelible white paint, SU, meaning Soviet Union. I already knew that mark, having seen it more than once on the backs of our Russian POWs, as they wandered sadly and guiltily toward the army that was approaching to free them. They had been freed, but there was no shared happiness in that liberation. Their compatriots glowered at them even more grimly than at the Germans. And as soon as they crossed the front lines, they were arrested and imprisoned. The 7th prisoner was a German civilian in a black 3-piece suit, a black overcoat, and black hat. He was over 50, tall, well-groomed, and his white face had been nurtured on gentleman's food. I completed the 4th pair, and the Tatar sergeant, chief of the convoy, gestured to me to pick up my sealed suitcase, which stood off to one side. It contained my officer's equipment, as well as all the papers which had been seized as evidence when I was arrested. What did he mean, carry my suitcase? He, a sergeant, wanted me, an officer, to pick up my suitcase and carry it, a large, heavy object, despite the new regulations, while beside me 6 men from the ranks would be marching empty-handed, and 1 representative of a conquered nation. I did not express this whole complex set of ideas to the sergeant. I merely said, "I am an officer. Let the German carry it." None of the prisoners turned around at my words. Turning around was forbidden. Only my mate in the 4th pair, also an SU, looked at me in astonishment. When he had been captured, our army wasn't yet like that. But the sergeant from counterintelligence was not surprised, even though I was not, of course, an officer in his eyes. Still, his indoctrination and mine coincided. He summoned the innocent German and ordered him to carry the suitcase. It was just as well the latter had not understood our conversation. The rest of us put our hands behind our backs. The former POWs did not have even 1 bag among them. They had left the motherland with empty hands, and that is exactly how they returned to her. So our column marched off, 4 pairs in file. We did not converse with our convoy, and it was absolutely forbidden to talk among ourselves, whether on the march, during a halt, or at overnight stops. As accused prisoners, we were required to move as though separated by invisible partitions, as though suffocated, each in his own solitary confinement cell. The early spring weather was changeable. At times, a thin mist hung in the air, and even on the firm highway the liquid mud squelched dismally beneath our boots. At times the heavens cleared, and the soft yellow sun, still uncertain of its talent, warmed the already thawing hillocks, and showed us, with perfect clarity, the world we were about to leave. At times a hostile squall flew to the attack, and tore from the black clouds a snow that was not really even white, which beat icily on faces and backs and feet, soaking through our overcoats and our footcloths. six backs ahead of me, six constant backs. There was more than enough time to examine and re-examine the crooked, hideous Brand's SU and the shiny black cloth on the German's back. There was more than enough time to reconsider my former life and to comprehend my present one, but I couldn't. I had been smashed on the head with an oak club, but I still didn't comprehend. Six backs. There was neither approval nor condemnation in their swing. The German, soon tired, he shifted the suitcase from hand to hand, grabbed at his heart, made signs to the convoy that he couldn't carry it any further. At that point, his neighbor in the pair, a POW who only a little while before had experienced God knows what in German captivity, but perhaps mercy, too, took the suitcase of his own free will and carried it. After that, the other POWs carried it in turn, also without being ordered to. And then the German again. All but me. And no one said a word to me. At one point we met a long string of empty carts. The drivers studied us with interest, and some of them jumped up to full height on top of the carts and stared. I understood very quickly that their stares and their malice were directed toward me. I was very sharply set off from the others. My coat was new, long, and cut to fit my figure snugly. My tabs had not yet been torn off, and in the filtered sunlight my buttons, also not cut off, burned with the glitter of cheap gold. It was easy to see I was an officer, with a look of newness, too, and newly taken into custody. Perhaps this very fall from the heights stimulated them, and gave them pleasure, suggesting some gleam of justice, but more likely they could not get it into their heads, stuffed with political indoctrination, that one of their own company commanders could be arrested in this way, and they all decided unanimously I had come from the other side. Aha! The Vlasov bastard got caught, did he? Shoot the rat! They were vehement in their rear-line wrath. The most intense patriotism always flourishes in the rear, and they added a good deal more in mother oaths. They regarded me as some kind of international operator who had nonetheless been caught, and as a result the advance at the front would move along faster, and the war would come to an end sooner. How was I to answer them? I was forbidden to utter a single word, and I would have had to explain my entire life to each and every one of them. What could I do to make them understand that I was not a spy, a saboteur, that I was their friend, that it was because of them that I was here? I smiled. Looking up at them, I smiled at them from a column of prisoners under escort. But my bared teeth seemed to them the worst kind of mockery, and they shook their fists and bellowed insults at me even more violently than before. I smiled in pride that I had been arrested not for stealing, nor treason, nor desertion, but because I had discovered, through my power of reasoning, the evil secrets of Stalin. I smiled at the thought that I wanted, and might still be able, to effect some small remedies and changes in our Russian way of life. But all that time my suitcase was being carried by others, and I didn't even feel remorseful about it. And if my neighbor, whose sunken cheeks were already covered with a soft 2-week growth of beard, and whose eyes were filled to overflowing with suffering and knowledge, had then and there reproached me in the clearest of clear Russian words for having disgraced the honor of a prisoner by appealing to the convoy for help, and had accused me of haughtiness, of setting myself up above the rest of them, I would not have understood him. I simply would not have understood what he was talking about. I was an officer. And if seven of us had to die on the way, and the eighth could have been saved by the convoy, what was to keep me from crying out, "Sergeant, save me! I am an officer!" And that's what an officer is, even when his shoulder boards aren't blue. And if they are blue, if he has been indoctrinated to believe that even among other officers he is the salt of the earth, and that he knows more than others, and is entrusted with more responsibility than others, and that, consequently, it is his duty to force a prisoner's head between his legs, and then to shove him like that into a pipe, why shouldn't he? I credited myself with unselfish dedication, but meanwhile I had been thoroughly prepared to be an executioner. And if I had gotten into an NKVD school under Yezhov, maybe I would have matured just in time for Beria. So let the reader who expects this book to be a political exposé slam its covers shut right now. If only it were all so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? During the life of any heart, this line keeps changing place. Sometimes it is squeezed one way by exuberant evil, and sometimes it shifts to allow enough space for good to flourish. One and the same human being is, at various ages, under various circumstances, a totally different human being. At times he is close to being a devil, at times to sainthood. But his name doesn't change, and to that name we ascribe the whole lot, good and evil. Socrates taught us, know thyself. Confronted by the pit into which we are about to toss those who have done us harm, we halt, stricken dumb. It is, after all, only because of the way things worked out that they were the executioners and we weren't. If Malutius Skuratov had summoned us, we too probably would have done our work well. From good to evil is one quaver, says the proverb, and correspondingly from evil to good. From the moment when our society was convulsed by the reminder of those illegalities and tortures, they began on all sides to explain, to write, to protest. Good people were there too, meaning in the NKVD MGB. We know which good people they're talking about. They were the ones who whispered to the old Bolsheviks, don't weaken, or even sneaked a sandwich into them, and who kicked all the rest around wherever they found them. But weren't there also some who rose above the party, who were good in a general human sense? Broadly speaking, they should not have been there. The organs avoided employing such people, eliminating them at the recruitment stage. And such people played their hand shrewdly so as to get out of it. During the war, a certain Leningrad aviator, after being discharged from the hospital in Ryazan, went to a TB clinic and begged, please find something wrong with me. I'm under orders to go into the organs. The radiologists dreamed up a touch of TB for him, and the organs dropped him post-haste. Whoever got in by mistake either adjusted to the milieu, or else was thrown out, or eased out, or even fell across the rails himself. Still, were there no good people left there? In Kishinev, a young Lieutenant Gaibist went to Father Viktor Shipovalnikov a full month before he was arrested. Get away from here! Go away! They plan to arrest you! Did he do this on his own, or did his mother send him to warn the priest? After the arrest, this young man was assigned to Father Viktor as an escort guard, and he grieved for him. Why didn't you go away? Or here's another. I had a platoon commander named Lieutenant Ovzianikov. At the front, no one was closer to me than he was. During half the war, we ate from the same pot. Even under enemy shellfire, we would gulp down our food between explosions so the stew wouldn't get cold. He was a peasant lad with a clean soul and a view of life so undistorted that neither officer candidate school nor being an officer had spoiled him in any degree. He even did what he could to soften my hard edges in many ways. Throughout his service as an officer, he concentrated on one thing only, preserving the lives and strength of his soldiers, many of whom were no longer young. He was the first to tell me what the Russian villages were like then and what the collective farms were like. He talked about all this without resentment, without protest, very simply and straightforwardly, just as a forest pool reflects the image of a tree and all its branches, even the smallest. He was deeply shocked by my arrest. He wrote me a combat reference containing the highest praise and got the divisional commander to sign it. After he was demobilized, he continued to try to help me, through my relatives, and this, mind you, was in 1947, which was not very different from 1937. At my interrogation, I had many reasons to be afraid on his account, especially lest they read my war diary, which contained the stories he'd told me. When I was rehabilitated in 1957, I very much wanted to find him. I remembered his village address and wrote once and then again, but there was no reply. I discovered one thread I could follow, that he had graduated from the Yaroslavl Pedagogical Institute. When I inquired there, they replied, he was sent to work in the organs of state security. Fine, all the more interesting. I wrote to him at his city address, but there was no reply. Several years passed, and Ivan Denisovich was published. Well, I thought, now he'll turn up. No. 3 years later, I asked one of my Yaroslavl correspondents to go to him and personally hand him a letter. My correspondent did as I asked, and wrote me, evidently, he has never read Ivan Denisovich. And truly, why should they know how things go with prisoners after they've been sentenced? This time, Ovzianikov couldn't keep silent any longer. He wrote, after the institute, they offered me work in the organs, and it seemed to me I would be just as successful there. What did he mean, successful? I cannot say that I have prospered remarkably in my new walk of life. There are some things I did not like, but I work hard, and, if I am not mistaken, I shall not let my comrades down. And that's the justification, comradeship. He ended, I no longer think about the future. And that is all. Allegedly, he had not received my previous letters. Evidently, he doesn't want to see me. But if we had met, I think this would have been a better chapter. In Stalin's last years, he had already become an interrogator, during those very years when they handed out a 25-year sentence to everyone who came along. How did everything in his consciousness recircuit itself? How did everything black out? But remembering the once selfless, dedicated boy, as fresh as spring water, can I possibly believe that everything in him changed beyond recall, that there are no living tendrils left? When the interrogator Goldman gave Vera Korneyeva the 206 form on non-disclosure to sign, she began to catch on to her rights, and then she began to go into the case in detail, involving as it did all 17 members of their religious group. Goldman raged, but he had to let her study the file. In order not to be bored waiting for her, he led her to a large office where half a dozen employees were sitting, and left her there. At first she read quietly, but then a conversation began, perhaps because the others were bored, and Vera launched aloud into a real religious sermon. One would have had to know her to appreciate this to the full. She was a luminous person, with a lively mind and a gift of eloquence, even though in freedom she had been no more than a lathe operator, a stable girl, and a housewife. They listened to her impressively, now and then asking questions in order to clarify something or other. It was catching them from an unexpected side of things. People came in from other offices, and the room filled up. Even though they were only typists, stenographers, file clerks, and not interrogators, in 1946 this was still their milieu, the organs. It is impossible to reconstruct her monologue. She managed to work in all sorts of things, including the question of traitors of the motherland. Why were there no traitors in the 1812 War of the Fatherland, when there was still serfdom? It would have been natural to have traitors then. But mostly she spoke about religious faith and religious believers. Formerly, she declared, unbridled passions were the basis for everything. Steal the stolen goods. And in that state of affairs, religious believers were naturally a hindrance to you. But now, when you want to build and prosper in this world, why do you persecute your best citizens? They represent your most precious material. After all, believers don't need to be watched. They do not steal, and they do not shirk. Do you think you can build a just society on a foundation of self-serving and envious people? Everything in the country is falling apart. Why do you spit in the hearts of your best people? Separate church and state properly, and do not touch the church. You will not lose a thing thereby. Are you materialists? In that case, put your faith in education, in the possibility that it will, as they say, disperse religious faith. But why arrest people? At this point, Goldman came in and started to interrupt rudely, but everyone shouted at him, "Oh, shut up! Keep quiet! Go ahead, woman, talk!" And how should they have addressed her? Citizeness? Comrade? Those forms of address were forbidden, and these people were bound by the conventions of Soviet life. But woman? That was how Christ had spoken, and you couldn't go wrong there. And Vera continued in the presence of her interrogator. So there, in the MGB office, those people listened to Korneyeva, and why did the words of an insignificant prisoner touch them so near the quick? That same D. Terekhov, I mentioned earlier, remembers to this day the first prisoner he sentenced to death. I was sorry for him. His memory obviously clings to something that came from his heart. But after that first one, he forgot many and no longer kept count anymore. An episode with Terekhov, attempting to prove to me the fairness of the judicial system under Khrushchev, he energetically struck the plate glass desk top with his hand and cut his wrist on the edge. He rang for help. His subordinates were at the ready. The senior officer on duty brought him iodine and hydrogen peroxide. Continuing the conversation, he helplessly held dampened cotton to the wound. It appears that his blood coagulates poorly. And thus God showed him clearly the limitations of the human being, and he had delivered verdicts, imposed death sentences on others. No matter how icy the jailers in the big house in Leningrad, the innermost nucleus of the heart, for a nucleus has its own nucleus, had to continue to exist, did it not? N.P. blank V.A. recalls the time when she was being taken to interrogation by an impassive, silent woman guard with unseeing eyes, when suddenly the bombs began to explode right next to the big house, and it sounded as if at the next moment they would fall directly on them. The terrified guard threw her arms around her prisoner and embraced her, desperate for human companionship and sympathy. Then the bombing stopped, and her eyes became unseeing again. "Hands behind your back. Move along." Well, of course, there was no great merit in that, to become a human being at the moment of death. Similarly, loving one's own children is no proof of virtue. People often try to excuse scoundrels by saying, "He's a good family man." The chairman of the Supreme Court, I.T. Golyakov, is praised. He enjoyed digging in his garden. He loved books. He used to browse around used and rare bookstores. He knew the work of Tolstoy, Korolenko, and Chekhov. Well, what did he learn from them? How many thousands did he destroy? Or, for example, that colonel, Concordia Yossa's friend, who had roared with laughter in the Vladimir detention prison at the memory of locking up a group of old Jews in an ice-filled root cellar, had been afraid of one thing only during all his debaucheries, that his wife might find out about them. She believed in him, regarded him as noble, and this faith of hers was precious to him. But do we dare accept that feeling as a bridgehead to virtue in his heart? And why is it that for nearly 200 years the security forces have hung on to the colour of the heavens? That was what they wore in Lermontov's lifetime. And you, blue uniforms! Then came blue service caps, blue shoulder boards, blue tabs, and then they were ordered to make themselves less conspicuous, and the blue brims were hidden from the gratitude of the people, and everything blue on heads and shoulders was made narrower, until what was left was piping, narrow rims, but still blue. Is this only a masquerade? Or is it that even blackness must, every so often, however rarely, partake of the heavens? It would be beautiful to think so, but when one learns, for example, the nature of the Yagoda's striving towards the sacred, an eyewitness from the group around Gorky, who was close to Yagoda at the time, reports that in the vestibule of the bathhouse on Yagoda's estate near Moscow, icons were placed so that Yagoda and his comrades, after undressing, could use them as targets for revolver practice before going in to take their baths. Just how are we to understand that? As the act of an evildoer? What sort of behavior is it? Do such people really exist? We would prefer to say that such people cannot exist, that there aren't any. It is permissible to portray evildoers in a story for children, so as to keep the picture simple. But when the great world literature of the past, Shakespeare, Schiller, Dickens, inflates and inflates images of evildoers of the blackest shades, it seems somewhat farcical and clumsy to our contemporary perception. The trouble lies in the way these classic evildoers are pictured. They recognize themselves as evildoers, and they know their souls are black. And they reason, "I cannot live unless I do evil, so I'll set my father against my brother. I'll drink the victim's sufferings until I'm drunk with them." Iago very precisely identifies his purposes and his motives as being black and born of hate. But no, that's not the way it is. To do evil, a human being must first of all believe that what he's doing is good, or else that it's a well-considered act in conformity with natural law. Fortunately, it isn't the nature of the human being to seek a justification for his actions. Macbeth's self-justifications were feeble, and his conscience devoured him. Yes, even Iago was a little lamb, too. The imagination and the spiritual strength of Shakespeare's evildoers stopped short at a dozen corpses, because they had no ideology. Ideology, that is what gives evildoing its long-sought justification, and gives the evildoer the necessary steadfastness and determination. That is the social theory which helps to make his acts seem good instead of bad in his own and others' eyes, so that he won't hear reproaches and curses, but will receive praise and honours. That was how the agents of the Inquisition fortified their wills, by invoking Christianity. The conquerors of foreign lands, by extolling the grandeur of their motherland. The colonizers, by civilization. The Nazis, by race. And the Jacobins, early and late, by equality, brotherhood, and the happiness of future generations. Thanks to ideology, the 20th century was fated to experience evil-doing on a scale calculated in the millions. This cannot be denied, nor passed over, nor suppressed. How, then, do we dare insist that evil-doers do not exist? And who was it that destroyed these millions? Without evil-doers, there would have been no archipelago. There was a rumour going the rounds between 1918 and 1920 that the Petrograd Cheka, headed by Yuritsky, and the Odessa Cheka, headed by Deich, did not shoot all those condemned to death, but fed some of them alive to the animals in the city zoos. I do not know whether this is truth or calumny, or if there were any such cases, how many there were, but I wouldn't set out to look for proof either. Following the practice of the Blue Caps, I would propose that they prove to us that this was impossible. How else could they get food for the zoos in those famine years? Take it away from the working class? Those enemies were going to die anyway, so why couldn't their deaths support the zoo economy of the Republic and thereby assist our march into the future? Wasn't it expedient? That is the precise line the Shakespearean evildoer could not cross, but the evildoer with ideology does cross it, and his eyes remain dry and clear. Physics is aware of phenomena which occur only at threshold magnitudes, which do not exist at all until a certain threshold encoded by and known to nature has been crossed. No matter how intense a yellow light you shine on a lithium sample, it will not emit electrons. But as soon as a weak bluish light begins to glow, it does emit them. The threshold of the photoelectric effect has been crossed. You can cool oxygen to 100 degrees below zero centigrade and exert as much pressure as you want. It does not yield, but remains a gas. But as soon as minus 183 degrees is reached, it liquefies and begins to flow. Evidently, evil doing also has a threshold magnitude. Yes, a human being hesitates and bobs back and forth between good and evil all his life. He slips, falls back, clambers up, repents, things begin to darken again. But just so long as the threshold of evil-doing is not crossed, the possibility of returning remains, and he himself is still within reach of our hope. But when, through the density of evil actions, the result either of their own extreme degree or of the absoluteness of his power, he suddenly crosses that threshold, he has left humanity behind and without, perhaps, the possibility of return. From the most ancient times, justice has been a two-part concept. Virtue triumphs, and vice is punished. We have been fortunate enough to live to a time when virtue, though it does not triumph, is nonetheless not always tormented by attack dogs. Beaten down, sickly, virtue has now been allowed to enter in all its tatters and sit in the corner, as long as it doesn't raise its voice. However, no one dares say a word about vice. Yes, they did mock virtue, but there was no vice in that. Yes, so and so many millions did get mowed down, but no one was to blame for it. And if someone pipes up, "What about those who..." The answer comes from all sides, reproachfully and amicably at first. What are you talking about, comrade? Why open old wounds? Even in connection with one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, the retired blue caps living on pensions objected, because the book might reopen the wounds of those who had been imprisoned in camp. Allegedly, they were the ones to be protected. Then they go after you with an oaken club. Shut up! Haven't you had enough yet? You think you've been rehabilitated? In that same period, by 1966, 86,000 Nazi criminals had been convicted in West Germany. Meanwhile, in East Germany, nothing of the sort is to be heard, which means that there they have been shod with new shoes. They are valued in the service of the state. And still, we choke with anger here. We do not hesitate to devote to the subject page after newspaper page, and hour after hour of radio time. We even stay after work to attend protest meetings and vote, "Too few! 86,000 are too few, and 20 years is too little. It must go on and on." And during the same period, in our own country, according to the reports of the Military Collegium of the Supreme Court, about 10 men have been convicted. What takes place beyond the Oder and the Rhine gets us all worked up. What goes on in the environs of Moscow and behind the green fences near Sochi, or the fact that the murderers of our husbands and fathers ride through our streets and we make way for them as they pass, doesn't get us worked up at all, doesn't touch us. That would be digging up the past. Meanwhile, if we translate 86,000 West Germans into our own terms, on the basis of comparative population figures, it would become 250,000. But in a quarter century, we have not tracked down anyone. We have not brought anyone to trial. It is their wounds we are afraid to reopen. And as a symbol of them all, the smug and stupid Molotov lives on at Granovsky No. 3, a man who has learned nothing at all even now, though he is saturated with our blood and nobly crosses the sidewalk to seat himself in his long, wide automobile. Here is a riddle not for us contemporaries to figure out. Why is Germany allowed to punish its evildoers and Russia is not? What kind of disastrous path lies ahead of us if we do not have the chance to purge ourselves of that putrefaction rotting inside our body? What, then, can Russia teach the world? In the German trials, an astonishing phenomenon takes place from time to time. The defendant clasps his head in his hands, refuses to make any defense, and from then on asks no concessions from the court. He says that the presentation of his crimes, revived and once again confronting him, has filled him with revulsion, and he no longer wants to live. That is the ultimate height a trial can attain, when evil is so utterly condemned that even the criminal is revolted by it. A country which has condemned evil 86,000 times from the rostrum of a court and irrevocably condemned it in literature and among its young people year by year, step by step, is purged of it. What are we to do? Some day our descendants will describe our several generations as generations of driveling do-nothings. First we submissively allowed them to massacre us by the millions, and then with devoted concern we tended the murderers in their prosperous old age. What are we to do if the great Russian tradition of penitence is incomprehensible and absurd to them? What are we to do if the animal terror of hearing even 100th part of all they subjected others to outweighs in their hearts any inclination to justice? If they cling greedily to the harvest of benefits they have watered with the blood of those who perished? It is clear enough that those men who turned the handle of the meat grinder, even as late as 1937, are no longer young. They are 50 to 80 years old. They have lived the best years of their lives, prosperously, well-nourished and comfortable, so that it is too late for any kind of equal retribution as far as they are concerned. But let us be generous. We will not shoot them. We will not pour salt water into them, nor bury them in bedbugs, nor bridle them into a swan dive, nor keep them on sleepless stand-up for a week, nor kick them with jackboots, nor beat them with rubber truncheons, nor squeeze their skulls in iron rings, nor push them into a cell so that they lie atop one another like pieces of baggage. We will not do any of the things they did. But for the sake of our country and our children, we have the duty to seek them all out and bring them all to trial. Not to put them on trial so much as their crimes, and to compel each one of them to announce loudly, "Yes, I was an executioner and a murderer." And if these words were spoken in our country only 250,000 times, a just proportion if we are not to fall behind West Germany, would it perhaps be enough? It is unthinkable in the 20th century to fail to distinguish between what constitutes an abominable atrocity that must be prosecuted and what constitutes that past which ought not to be stirred up. We have to condemn publicly the very idea that some people have the right to repress others, in keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface. We are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age, we are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. It is for this reason, and not because of the weakness of indoctrinational work, that they are growing up indifferent. Young people are acquiring the conviction that foul deeds are never punished on earth, that they always bring prosperity. It is going to be uncomfortable, horrible, to live in such a country. Chapter 5. First Cell, First Love. How is one to take the title of this chapter, A Cell and Love, in the same breath? Ah, well, probably it has to do with Leningrad during the blockade, and you were imprisoned in the big house. In that case, it would be very understandable. That's why you were still alive, because they shoved you in there. It was the best place in Leningrad, not only for the interrogators who even lived there and had offices in the cellars in case of shelling. Joking aside, in Leningrad in those days no one washed and everyone's face was covered with a black crust. But in the big house, prisoners were given a hot shower every 10th day. Well, it's true that only the corridors were heated for the jailers. The cells were left unheated, but after all there were water pipes in the cells that worked and a toilet, and where else in Leningrad could you find that? And the bread ration was just like the ration outside, barely 4.5 ounces. In addition, there was broth made from slaughtered horses once a day, and thin gruel once a day as well. It was a case of the cats being envious of the dog's life. But what about punishment cells? And what about the supreme measure, execution? No, that isn't what the chapter title is about. Not at all. You sit down and half close your eyes and try to remember them all. How many different cells you were imprisoned in during your term. It is difficult even to count them. And in each one there were people. People. There might be 2 people in one, 150 in another. You were imprisoned for 5 minutes in one, and all summer long in another. But in every case, out of all the cells you've been in, your first cell is a very special one. The place where you first encountered others like yourself, doomed to the same fate. All your life you will remember it with an emotion that you otherwise experience only in remembering your first love, and those people who shared with you the floor and air of that stone cubicle during those days when you rethought your entire life, will from time to time be recollected by you as members of your own family. Yes, in those days, they were your only family. What you experience in your first interrogation cell parallels nothing in your entire previous life, or your whole subsequent life. No doubt prisons have stood for thousands of years before you came along, and may continue to stand after you, too, longer than one would like to think. But that first interrogation cell is unique and inimitable. Maybe it was a terrible place for a human being, a lice-laden, bed-bug-infested lock-up, without windows, without ventilation, without bunks, and with a dirty floor, a box called a KPZ. KPZ equals cell for preliminary detention. DPZ equals house of preliminary detention. In other words, where interrogations are conducted, not where sentences are served. In the village Soviet, at the police station, in the railroad station, or in some port. The KPZs and the DPZs are scattered across the face of our land in the greatest abundance. There are masses of prisoners in them. Or maybe it was solitary in the Archangel prison, where the glass had been smeared over with red lead so that the only rays of God's maimed light which crept into you were crimson, and where a 15-watt bulb burned constantly in the ceiling day and night. Or solitary in the city of Choibalsan, where, for 6 months at a time, 14 of you were crowded onto 7 square yards of floor space, in such a way that you could only shift your bent legs in unison. Or it was one of the Lefortovo psychological cells, like number 111, which was painted black and also had a day and night 25-watt bulb, but was in all other respects like every other Lefortovo cell, asphalt floor, the heating valve out in the corridor, where only the guards had access to it, and above all, that interminable, irritating roar from the wind tunnel of the neighbouring Central Aero and Hydrodynamics Institute, a roar one could not believe was unintentional, a roar which would make a bowl or cup vibrate so violently that it would slip off the edge of the table, a roar which made it useless to converse and during which one could sing at the top of one's lungs and the jailer wouldn't even hear. And then, when the roar stopped, there would ensue a sense of relief and felicity superior to freedom itself. But it was not the dirty floor, nor the murky walls, nor the odour of the latrine bucket that you loved, but those fellow prisoners with whom you were about faced at command, and that something which beat between your heart and theirs, and their sometimes astonishing words, and then, too, the birth within you on that very spot of free-floating thoughts you had so recently been unable to leap up or rise to. And how much it had cost you to last out until that first cell. You had been kept in a pit, or in a box, or in a cellar. No one had addressed a human word to you. No one had looked at you with a human gaze. All they did was to peck at your brain and heart with iron beaks, and when you cried out or groaned, they laughed. For a week or a month you had been an abandoned waif, alone among enemies, and you had already said goodbye to reason and to life, and you had already tried to kill yourself by falling from the radiator in such a way as to smash your brains against the iron cone of the valve. Then, all of a sudden, you were alive again, and you were brought into your friends, and reason returned to you. That's what your first cell is. You waited for that cell. You dreamed of it almost as eagerly as of freedom. Meanwhile, they kept shoving you around between cracks in the wall and holes in the ground, from Lefortovo into some legendary, diabolical Sukhanovka. Sukhanovka was the most terrible prison the MGB had. Its very name was used to intimidate prisoners. Interrogators would hiss it threateningly, and you'd not be able to question those who had been there. Either they were insane and talking only disconnected nonsense, or they were dead. Sukhanovka was a former monastery dating back to Catherine the Great. It consisted of two buildings, one in which prisoners served out their terms, and the other a structure that contained 68 monks' cells and was used for interrogations. The journey there in a black Maria took 2 hours, and only a handful of people knew that the prison was really just a few miles from Lenin's Gorky estate, and near the former estate of Zinaida Volkanskaya. The countryside surrounding it was beautiful. There they stunned the newly arrived prisoner with a stand-up punishment cell, again so narrow that when he was no longer able to stand, he had to sag, supported by his bent knees propped against the wall. There was no alternative. They kept prisoners thus for more than a day to break their resistance. But they ate tender, tasty food at Sukhanovka, which was like nothing else in the MGB, because it was brought in from the architect's rest home. They didn't maintain a separate kitchen to prepare hogwash. However, the amount one architect would eat, including fried potatoes and meatballs, was divided among 12 prisoners. As a result, the prisoners were not only always hungry, but also exceedingly irritable. The cells were all built for two, but prisoners under interrogation were usually kept in them singly. The dimensions were 5 by 6.5 feet. To be absolutely precise, they were 156 centimetres by 209 centimetres. How do we know, through a triumph of engineering calculation and a strong heart, that even Sukhanovka could not break? The measurements were the work of Alexander D., who would not allow them to drive him to madness or despair. He resisted by striving to use his mind to calculate distances. In Lefortovo, he counted steps, converted them into kilometers, remembered from a map how many kilometers it was from Moscow to the border, and then how many across all Europe, and how many across the Atlantic Ocean. He was sustained in this by the hope of returning to America. And in 1 year, in Lefortovo solitary, he got, so to speak, halfway across the Atlantic. Thereupon, they took him to Sukhanovka. Here, realizing how few would survive to tell of it, and all our information about it comes from him, he invented a method of measuring the cell. The numbers 10/22 were stamped on the bottom of his prison bowl, and he guessed that 10 was the diameter of the bottom, and 22 the diameter of the outside edge. Then he pulled a thread from a towel, made himself a tape measure, and measured everything with it. Then he began to invent a way of sleeping standing up, propping his knees against the small chair, and of deceiving the guard into thinking his eyes were open. He succeeded in this deception, and that was how he managed not to go insane when Ryumin kept him sleepless for a month. Two little round stools were welded to the stone floor, like stumps, and at night, if the guard unlocked a cylinder lock, a shelf dropped from the wall onto each stump and remained there for 7 hours. In other words, during the hours of interrogation, since there was no daytime interrogation at Sukhanovka at all. And a little straw mattress, large enough for a child, also dropped down. During the day, the stool was exposed and free, but one was forbidden to sit on it. In addition, a table lay, like an ironing board, on four upright pipes. The fortochka in the window, the small hinged pane for ventilation, was always closed except for 10 minutes in the morning when the guard cranked it open. The glass in the little window was reinforced. There were never any exercise periods out of doors. Prisoners were taken to the toilet at 6 a.m. only, that is, when no one's stomach needed it. There was no toilet period in the evening. There were two guards for each block of 7 cells, so that was why the prisoners could be under almost constant inspection through the peephole, the only interruption being the time it took the guard to step past 2 doors to a third. And that was the purpose of Silent Sukhanovka, to leave the prisoner not a single moment for sleep, not a single stolen moment for privacy. You were always being watched and always in their power. But if you endured the whole duel with insanity and all the trials of loneliness, and had stood firm, you deserved your first cell, and now when you got into it, your soul would heal. If you had surrendered, if you had given in and betrayed everyone, you were also ready for your first cell, but it would have been better for you not to have lived until that happy moment, and to have died a victor in the cellar, without having signed a single sheet of paper. Now, for the first time, you were about to see people who were not your enemies. Now, for the first time, you were about to see others who were alive, who were travelling your road, and whom you could join to yourself with the joyous word, we. And if this was in the big house in Leningrad during the siege, you may also have seen cannibals, those who had eaten human flesh, those who had traded in human livers from dissecting rooms, were for some reason kept by the MGB with the political prisoners. Yes, that word which you may have despised out in freedom when they used it as a substitute for your own individuality. All of us, like one man, or we are deeply angered, or we demand, or we swear, is now revealed to you as something sweet. You are not alone in the world. Wise, spiritual beings, human beings, still exist. I had been dueling for 4 days with the interrogator when the jailer, having waited until I lay down to sleep in my blindingly lit box, began to unlock my door. I heard him all right, but before he could say, "Get up, interrogation," I wanted to lie for another 0.03 seconds with my head on the pillow and pretend I was sleeping. But instead of the familiar command, the guard ordered, "Get up, pick up your bedding." Uncomprehending and unhappy because this was my most precious time, I wound on my footcloths, put on my boots, my overcoat, my winter cap, and clasped the government-issue mattress in my arms. The guard was walking on tiptoe and kept signalling me not to make any noise, as he led me down a corridor silent as the grave, through the fourth floor of the Lubyanka, past the desk of the section supervisor, past the shiny numbers on the cells and the olive-coloured covers of the peepholes, and unlocked cell 67. I entered, and he locked it behind me immediately. Even though only a quarter of an hour or so had passed since the signal to go to sleep had been given, the period allotted the prisoners for sleeping was so fragile and undependable and brief that by the time I arrived, the inhabitants of cell 67 were already asleep on their metal cots with their hands on top of the blankets. New measures of oppression, additions to the traditional prison regulations, were invented only gradually in the internal prisons of the GPU, NKVD, MGB. At the beginning of the 20s, prisoners were not subjected to this particular measure, and lights were turned off at night as in the ordinary world. But they began to keep the lights on the logical grounds that they needed to keep the prisoners in view at all times. When they used to turn the lights on for inspection, it had been even worse. Arms had to be kept outside the blanket, allegedly to prevent the prisoner from strangling himself beneath the blanket, and thus escaping his just interrogation. It was demonstrated experimentally that in the winter a human being always wants to keep his arms under the bedclothes for warmth. Consequently, the measure was made permanent. At the sound of the door opening, all three started and raised their heads for an instant. They, too, were waiting to learn which of them might be taken to interrogation. And those three lifted heads, those three unshaven, crumpled, pale faces, seemed to me so human, so dear, that I stood there hugging my mattress and smiled with happiness. And they smiled, and what a forgotten look that was, after only 1 week. "Are you from freedom?" they asked me. That was the question customarily put to a newcomer. "No," I replied, and that was a newcomer's usual first reply. They had in mind that I had probably been arrested recently, which meant that I came from freedom, and I, after 96 hours of interrogation, hardly considered that I was from freedom. Was I not already a veteran prisoner? Nonetheless, I was from freedom. The beardless old man with the black and very lively eyebrows was already asking me for military and political news. Astonishing. Even though it was late February, they knew nothing about the Yalta Conference, nor the encirclement of East Prussia, nor anything at all about our own attack below Warsaw in mid-January, nor even about the woeful December retreat of the Allies. According to regulations, those under interrogation were not supposed to know anything about the outside world, and here, indeed, they didn't. I was prepared to spend half the night telling them all about it, with pride, as though all the victories and advances were the work of my own hands. But at this point, the duty jailer brought in my cot, and I had to set it up without making any noise. I was helped by a young fellow my own age, also a military man. His tunic and aviator's cap hung on his cot. He had asked me, even before the old man spoke, not for news of the war, but for tobacco. But although I felt open-hearted toward my new friends, and although not many words had been exchanged in the few minutes since I joined them, I sensed something alien in this front-line soldier who was my contemporary, and as far as he was concerned, I clammed up immediately and forever. I had not yet even heard the word nasidka, stool pigeon, nor learned that there had to be one such stool pigeon in each cell, and I had not yet had time to think things over and conclude that I did not like this fellow, Georgi Kramarenko. But a spiritual relay, a sensor relay, had clicked inside me, and it had closed him off from me for good and all. I would not bother to recall this event, if it had been the only one of its kind. But soon, with astonishment and alarm, I became aware of the work of this internal sensor relay as a constant inborn trait. The years passed, and I lay on the same bunks, marched in the same formations, and worked in the same work brigades with hundreds of others. And always, that secret sensor relay, for whose creation I deserved not the least bit of credit, worked even before I remembered it was there, worked at the first sight of a human face and eyes, at the first sound of a voice, so that I opened my heart to that person either fully or just the width of a crack, or else shut myself off from him completely. This was so consistently unfailing that all the efforts of the state security officers to employ stool pigeons began to seem to me as insignificant as being pestered by gnats. After all, a person who has undertaken to be a traitor always betrays the fact in his face and in his voice, and even though some were more skilled in pretense, there was always something fishy about them. On the other hand, the sensor relay helped me distinguish those to whom I could, from the very beginning of our acquaintance, completely disclose my most precious depths and secrets, secrets for which heads roll. Thus it was that I got through 8 years of imprisonment, 3 years of exile, and another 6 years of underground authorship, which were in no wise less dangerous. During all those 17 years, I recklessly revealed myself to dozens of people and didn't make a misstep even once. I have never read about this trait anywhere, and I mention it here for those interested in psychology. It seems to me that such spiritual sensors exist in many of us, but because we live in too technological and rational an age, we neglect this miracle and don't allow it to develop. We set up the cot, and I was then ready to talk, in a whisper, of course, and lying down, so as not to be sent from this cozy nest into a punishment cell. But our third cellmate, a middle-aged man whose cropped head already showed the white bristles of imminent greyness, peered at me discontentedly and said with characteristic northern severity, "Tomorrow, night is for sleeping." That was the most intelligent thing to do. At any minute, one of us could have been pulled out for interrogation and held until 6 a.m., when the interrogator would go home to sleep, but we were forbidden to. One night of undisturbed sleep was more important than all the fates on earth. One more thing held me back, which I didn't quite catch right away, but had felt nonetheless from the first words of my story, although I could not at this early date find a name for it. As each of us had been arrested, everything in our world had switched places. A 180-degree shift in all our concepts had occurred, and the good news I had begun to recount with such enthusiasm might not be good news for us at all. My cellmates turned on their sides, covered their eyes with their handkerchiefs to keep out the light from the 200-watt bulb, wound towels around their upper arms, which were chilled from lying on top of the blankets, hid their lower arms furtively beneath them, and went to sleep. And I lay there, filled to the brim with the joy of being among them. 1 hour ago I could not have counted on being with anyone. I could have come to my end with a bullet in the back of my head, which was what the interrogator kept promising me, without having seen anyone at all. Interrogation still hung over me, but how far it had retreated. Tomorrow I would be telling them my story, though not talking about my case, of course, and they would be telling me their stories, too. How interesting tomorrow would be, one of the best days of my life. Thus, very early and very clearly, I had this consciousness that prison was not an abyss for me, but the most important turning point in my life. Every detail of the cell interested me. Sleep fled, and when the peephole was not in use, I studied it all furtively. Up there at the top of one wall was a small indentation the length of 3 bricks, covered by a dark blue paper blind. They had already told me it was a window. Yes, there was a window in the cell, and the blind served as an air raid blackout. Tomorrow there would be weak daylight, and in the middle of the day they would turn off the glaring light bulb. How much that meant, to have daylight in daytime. There was also a table in the cell. On it, in the most conspicuous spot, were a teapot, a chess set, and a small pile of books. I was not yet aware why they were so conspicuously positioned. It turned out to be another example of the Lubyanka system at work. During his once-a-minute peephole inspection, the jailer was supposed to make sure that the gifts of the prison administration were not being misused, that the teapot was not being used to break down the wall, that no one was swallowing the chessmen and thereby possibly cashing in his chips and ceasing to be a citizen of the USSR, and that no one was starting a fire with the books in the hope of burning down the whole prison. And a prisoner's eyeglasses were considered so potentially dangerous that they were not allowed to remain on the table during the night. The prison administration took them away until morning. What a cozy life! Chess, books, cots with springs, decent mattresses, clean linen. I could not remember having slept like this during the whole war. There was a worn parquet floor. One could take nearly 4 strides from window to door in the aisle between the cots. No, indeed, this central political prison was a real resort. And no shells were falling. I remembered their sound, the high-pitched sobbing way up overhead, then the rising whistle and the crash as they burst, and how tenderly the mortar shells whistled, and how everything trembled from the four blasts of what we called Dr. Goebbels' mortar rockets. And I remember the wet snow and mud near Hurmdit, where I had been arrested, which our men were still wading through to keep the Germans from breaking out of our encirclement. All right, then, the hell with you. If you don't want me to fight, I won't. Among our many lost values, there is one more. The high worth of those people who spoke and wrote Russian before us. It is odd that they are almost undescribed in our pre-revolutionary literature. Only very rarely do we feel their breath from Marina Tsvetaeva or from Mother Maria in her recollections of Bloch. They saw too much to settle on any one thing. They reached toward the sublime too fervently to stand firmly on the earth. Before society's fall, just such a stratum of wise, thinking people emerges, people who are that and nothing more. And how they were laughed at, how they were mocked, as though they stuck in the craw of people whose deeds and actions were single-minded and narrow-minded, and the only nickname they were christened with was Rot, because these people were a flower that bloomed too soon and breathed too delicate a fragrance. And so they were mowed down. These people were particularly helpless in their personal lives. They could neither bend with the wind, nor pretend, nor get by. Every word declared an opinion, a passion, a protest. And it was just such people the mowing machine cut down, just such people the chaff cutter shredded. I am almost fearful of saying it, but it seems as though on the eve of the 1970s, these people are emerging once again. That is surprising. It was almost too much to hope for. They had passed through these very same cells, but the cell walls, for the wallpaper had long since been stripped off, and they had been plastered, whitewashed, and painted more than once, gave off nothing of the past. On the contrary, the walls now tried to listen to us with hidden microphones. Nowhere is anything written down or reported of the former inhabitants of these cells, of the conversations held in them, of the thoughts with which earlier inmates went forth to be shot or to imprisonment on the Solovetsky Island. And now such a volume, which would be worth 40 freight car loads of our literature, will in all probability never be written. Those still alive recount to us all sorts of trivial details, that there used to be wooden trestle beds here, and that the mattresses were stuffed with straw. That, way back in 1920, before they put muzzles over the windows, the panes were whitewashed up to the top. By 1923, muzzles had been installed, although we unanimously ascribed them to barrier. They said that back in the 20s, prison authorities had been very lenient toward prisoners communicating with each other by knocking on the walls. This was a carryover from the stupid tradition in the Tsarist prisons, that if the prisoners were deprived of knocking, they would have no way to occupy their time. And another thing, back in the 20s, all the jailers were Latvians, from the Latvian Red Army units and others, and the food was all handed out by strapping Latvian women. All this was trivial detail, but it was certainly food for thought. I myself had needed very badly to get into this main Soviet political prison, and I was grateful that I had been sent here. I thought about Bukharin a great deal, and I wanted to picture the whole thing as it had actually been. However, I had the impression that we were by now merely the remnants, and that in this respect we might just as well have been in any provincial internal prison, one attached to a state security headquarters. Still, there was a good deal of status in being here, and there was no reason to be bored with my companions in my new cell. They were people to listen to and people with whom to compare notes. The old fellow with the lively eyebrows, and at 63 he in no way bore himself like an old man, was Anatoly Ilyich Fastenko. He was a big asset to our Lubyanka cell, both as a keeper of the old Russian prison traditions and as a living history of Russian revolutions. Thanks to all that he remembered, he somehow managed to put in perspective everything that had taken place in the past and everything that was taking place in the present. Such people are valuable not only in a cell. We badly need them in our society as a whole. Right there in our cell, we read Pastenko's name in a book about the 1905 revolution. He had been a social democrat for such a long, long time that in the end, it seemed, he had ceased to be one. He had been sentenced to his first prison term in 1904 while still a young man, but he had been freed outright under the manifesto proclaimed on October the 17th, 1905. Who among us has not learned by heart from our school history courses, as well as from the short course in the history of the Soviet Communist Party, that this provocative and foul manifesto was a mockery of freedom, that the Tsar had proclaimed freedom for the dead and prison for the living? But the epigram was bogus. The manifesto declared that all political parties were to be tolerated, and that a state Duma was to be convened, and it provided for an amnesty which was honest and extremely extensive. The fact that it had been issued under duress was something else again. Indeed, under its terms, none other than all political prisoners without exception were to be released without reference to the term and type of punishment they had been sentenced to. Only criminals remained imprisoned. The Stalin amnesty of July the 7th, 1945, true it was not issued under duress, was exactly the opposite. All the political prisoners remained imprisoned. His story about that amnesty was interesting. In those years, of course, there were no muzzles on the prison windows, and from the cells of the Belaya Tserkov prison in which Pastenko was being held, the prisoners could easily observe the prison courtyard and the street, and all arrivals and departures, and they could shout back and forth as they pleased to ordinary citizens outside. During the day of October the 17th, these outsiders, having learned of the amnesty by telegraph, announced the news to the prisoners. In their happiness, the political prisoners went wild with joy. They smashed window panes, broke down doors, and demanded that the prison warden release them immediately. And were any of them kicked right in the snout with jackboots, or put in punishment cells? Or was anyone deprived of library and commissary privileges? Of course not. In his distress, the warden ran from cell to cell and implored them, "Gentlemen, I beg of you, please be reasonable. I don't have the authority to release you on the basis of a telegraphed report. I must have direct orders from my superiors in Kiev. Please, I beg of you, you will have to spend the night here." And in actual fact, they were most barbarously kept there for one more day. After Stalin's amnesty, as I will recount later, those amnestied were held in prison for another 2 or 3 months, and were forced to slog away just as before. And no one considered this illegal. On getting back their freedom, Pastenko and his comrades immediately rushed to join the revolution. In 1906, he was sentenced to 8 years at hard labor, which meant 4 years in irons and 4 in exile. He served the first 4 years in the Sevastopol Central Prison, where, incidentally, during his stay, a mass escape was organized from outside by a coalition of revolutionary parties, the SRs, the anarchists, and the social democrats. A bomb blew a hole in the prison wall, big enough for a horse and rider to go through, and 2 dozen prisoners, not everyone who wanted to escape, but those who had been chosen ahead of time by their parties and, right inside the prison, had been equipped with pistols by the jailers, fled through the hole and escaped. All but one. Anatoly Pastenko was selected by the Russian Social Democratic Party not to escape, but to cause a disturbance in order to distract the attention of the guards. On the other hand, when he reached exile in the Yenisei area, he did not stay there long. Comparing his stories, and later those of others who had survived, with the well-known fact that under the Tsar our revolution has escaped from exile by the hundreds and hundreds, and more of them went abroad, one comes to the conclusion that the only prisoners who did not escape from Tsarist exile were the lazy ones, because it was so easy. Pastenko escaped, which is to say he simply left his place of exile without a passport. He went to Vladivostok, expecting to get aboard a steamer through an acquaintance there. Somehow, it did not work out. So then, still without a passport, he calmly crossed the whole of Mother Russia on a train, and went to the Ukraine, where he had been a member of the Bolshevik underground and where he had first been arrested. There he was given a false passport, and he left to cross the Austrian border. That particular step was so routine, and Pastenko felt himself so safe from pursuit, that he was guilty of an astonishing piece of carelessness. Having arrived at the border and having turned in his passport to the official there, he suddenly discovered he could not remember his new name. What was he to do? There were 40 passengers altogether, and the official had already begun to call off their names. Pastenko thought up a solution. He pretended to be asleep. He listened as the passports were handed back to their owners, and he noted that the name Makarov was called several times without anyone responding. But even at this point, he was not absolutely certain it was his name. Finally, the dragon of the imperial regime bent down to the underground revolutionary and politely tapped him on the shoulder. "Mr. Makarov, Mr. Makarov, please, here is your passport."